that's right. We have sunny skies down here in Greenwood, South Carolina. Looks like it's going to be a beautiful day, high in the mid-50s. And I have Congressman Jeff Duncan. Are you jealous at all, Jeff, that we've got sunshine down here today?
Well, I am, but you know I like winter too. So in Northern Virginia, it is snowing fairly steady right now, and I don't know whether it's sticking or not, but I'm ready to get back to South Carolina this evening, Ann, and enjoy that great Palmetto State weather.
That's right. And I suppose you got a Super Bowl party, right?
My Super Bowl party will consist of me and my wife and my boys watching it on our TV and maybe enjoying some chips and dip. That's about it.
That's about it. Okay. Well, who are you pulling for in the Super Bowl?
You know, I like both teams. I probably like Russell Wilson and Seattle a little more than New England this year, although I'm usually a Tom Brady and New England fan. So, really, I just want to see a good football game and not a blowaway one way or the other.
Yeah, I agree. That's what makes it most interesting. But talk about blowaway games and everything. How's it going up there in Washington, D.C.?
Well, you know, we've seen a little bit of movement on Keystone Pipeline yesterday in the Senate. That's a good thing. We're going to have to probably either adopt their version or a slight conference change. But bottom line, it's going to the White House. It'll be on the president's desk, and he makes the decision whether to sign it or veto it. And America will watch equally because he hasn't issued a single veto in his presidency.
And he doesn't have Harry Reid to protect it from not going to his desk now, so it will be interesting. One of the big conversations that I've heard out there, and I don't really understand it, since we had six Democrats sign on to send it up to the president through the Senate, I do understand it has to be reworked between the two bodies, but they're already saying that they don't have the votes to override the veto. I mean, that's kind of premature, isn't it?
I think it is, and we can't govern on whether the president's going to veto a bill or not. I think the Congress, Republican House, and Senate now have to pass bills out to the president's desk which reflect Republican ideals, which show how we would govern, and whether it's, you know, pro-life issues or whether it's cutting spending or whether it's reining in debt or whether it's shrinking the size and scope of government or whether it's creating jobs like Keystone Pipeline and energy bills that will come up. We have got to pass those, and we have to send them to the Senate. And One frustration I have with my House leadership is they continually say, well, we can't pass this because it doesn't have 60 votes in the Senate. You know what? Let's worry about the House. Let's worry about passing bills that reflect the conservative majority in the House of Representatives and send them to the Senate. If they change it to get something to 60 votes, so be it. That's what the legislative process is all about. So I'm not worrying about the Senate. I'm worrying about the House and what we can do to govern and govern more from the right, in my opinion, works best.
Well, you know, that brings me to another question about the actual feel, shall we say, of the House up there. I know that when we had the speaker discussion, you and I discussed it, and I guess in the end you did decide to vote against John Boehner. Have you gotten any blowback from doing this?
No, not really. In fact, all but one that I know of, people from my district that I've heard from have praised me for that vote.
Oh, I meant from John Boehner. I mean, have you been banished?
No, you know, John and I, the Speaker and I, have had conversations. And, if I see any retribution in this Congress, I haven't seen it yet. So we will see. I think he's being pushed by a lot of his colleagues and some of the senior members to do something toward those that voted against him. But I think he saw that number of 25, and that's a large number. It wasn't quite enough, but he knows there's more that had anxiety, and that if there's retribution, there could be a rebellion on his hands. And so I think he's going to tread very, very lightly on that, and that's just my opinion.
Sure. Now, you know, as far as where do you think? Are Republicans becoming more middle of the road? I mean, I thought there was a real conservative movement, you know, the Tea Party-esque type movement. But it seems when you look at Congress and what's happening, it seems to be more in the middle. What is your feeling?
Well, you know, after the 2010 election and in early 2011, it was almost like the Tea Party conservatives and the freshman class were told to sit in the corner. Thanks for making us the majority, but sit in the corner and shut up. We're going to show you how to govern. And that was the wrong play. They should have used us more. And I think now, after 4 years of conservative Republicans trying to to push the leadership to the right. I think you're going to see us more vocal. I think you're going to see us more engaged in making sure that these, you know, crime and abuse type situations, these fiscal cliffs, these default threats and these shutdown threats don't actually happen, that we work early enough and we push conservative legislation. But for 4 years now, the House has governed more from the middle, and I just don't think that's successful. Leadership will point to the election returns and the numbers we picked up in the House and went in the Senate as an affirmation of the last 4 years and their procedures and their policies. I disagree with that. I think it was a pushback against the Obama administration and the bad policies and the desire of America to stop these bad things happening with the EPA, these bad things happening with the IRS, these bailouts and takeovers, these lies to the American people, this targeting of groups. They want all that stopped. I think the election was more about stopping the Obama administration's policies than it was about affirmation of what and how the House leadership governed in the last 4 years.
Well, I think that's what we all wanted to take away from it. It did that message get to President Obama is what I was questioning, because I have seen no pullback on his part.
No, that's right. And so we've got to figure out now, given the situation that we're in, we've got a strong majority in the House. We've got 54 in the Senate. And we've got to figure out how to make sure that we get the most conservative legislation pushed through that we can. I think you've seen that most recently on the border bill, which I supported the border bill in committee as we were working behind the scenes with Chairman McCaul to make it a better bill once or before it got to the floor. And that's put more fencing in, more miles with that to comply with the Secure Fence Act, to put some language in there dealing with catch and release policies by the Obama administration. That particular bill does have to have judiciary to sign off on the adjudication and processing of those that are detained from crossing the border. So we do have to have some other committee jurisdiction involvement in it. But what we did then is we stopped that bill from coming to the floor immediately, which is what leadership wanted to do, to try to make it a better bill. And I think we will have a better bill by the time it comes out in March. So I think that's where you're already seeing the impact of the conservatives in this Congress, and we've been able to do that.
Now, of course, this part of this bill, isn't it, is about building the fence. And I was reading something that I don't remember who was saying that, you know, that we don't need 700 miles of fence.
We do need 700 miles. It's just it's not contiguous. There are areas that don't need fencing. There are no illegal activity crossing right there. So I believe strategic fencing is the key. Israel proves that, in that if you put up fencing and it's high enough and strong enough, then it makes the bad guys have to go way out of their way to get around it. And so you have time to recognize that threat and to apprehend them. I think that's the same thing with the smugglers and the other bad guys, you know, with nefarious activity trying to come across our border. Let's put an obstacle in their way. Let's make it harder. Let's make it longer time for them to get around. Let's push them into some corridors where we can have a force multiplier effect and put our force there to apprehend them in those drug corridors, in the mountains, and areas where you can't put fencing. If you put people in corridors, you can surely find them. But if you've got a 2,000 mile wide open border, you have very much difficulty in apprehending. So I think fencing does work as long as it's strategic, and I support more fencing.
Sure. Now, we've had that law actually on the book, haven't we, since 2006, about fencing the border?
We did, but just know that in 2008, when the Democrats took control of Congress and had the president, that they changed that 2006 Secure Fence Act. They did away with the funding and actually changed the law where it didn't require the number of miles of fence that Duncan Hunter and so many others had pushed hard for in 2006. And so it was the Barack Obama administration and the Pelosi-Reid Congress that actually changed the Secure Fence Act. We're trying to change it back and put more fencing in place, and it's the right call for America because it makes it easier for our guys in the field with the Border Patrol and ICE and CBP. It makes it easier for them.
And if I'm reading this correctly, isn't part of the law is that you can't grant amnesty and visas and everything until the fence is in place?
Well, I mean, that's kind of a similar but separate issue. We want to make sure that the catch and release policies, I mean, if somebody walks across a border or climbs over a ladder, or climbs a ladder over a fence, and they're apprehended on our side of the border, they've broken our law. But right now, under the policies of Barack Obama, if a Customs and Border Patrol agent catches someone for crossing the border, and even if they're sitting there looking at them and watch them cross, and they apprehend them and say, hey, you broke the law, but there's really nothing I can do, so have a good day, enjoy America. That's what's happening now. What we need to do is have that person detained right there and taken back across the border at another point and repatriated into their country. That's what the law says, but that's not what's being done due to the policies of the president and his executive memo of granting, you know, basically amnesty to anyone that comes here. And so all you're doing is dangling a huge carrot out in front of folks that want to try to come here illegally and who don't want to go through the process. And I'm willing to have a conversation about legal immigration at some point in time down the road, but not until we secure a border, not until we start enforcing the rule of law. That's so important, and the rule of law is a huge component of that.
Sure. Now, what is happening on the Homeland Security, the part of the budget that did not get approved, am I correct on this, about funding this new immigration amnesty program?
Well, really, that's where we are right now. And the crime of us, which I didn't vote for because I felt like this wasn't the perfect play or a good play. And I think I'm going to be proven right in the long run. But we had so many cards to play in the deck back in December when the CR government funding bill ran out on December the 11th. We could have at that point sent a bill up to the president that defunded EPA to a great extent, a lot of his pet programs. We could have defunded the IRS and their basically bad practices. We could have cut funding to the White House even, and my budget's been cut 21% in 4 years. The White House budget hadn't been cut at all. We could have made them equal to us, and that would have cut out a lot of staffers at the White House. There were a lot of different plays we had, and we weren't willing to do that. And we operated on crisis. The government was going to shut down at midnight. A 1,600-page bill filed on Tuesday that I was supposed to vote on Thursday morning. We didn't have time to read it. Just a lot of different reasons. So what they did is they funded all of government with until the end of the fiscal year, which is September 30th, with the exception of DHS, which they only funded until the end of February 27th. And so what their play was, we will focus on funding DHS but not funding the part that the president is using to institute his executive amnesty. And we'll fight that battle then. Well, what's going to happen is you're going to hear a shutdown of the Homeland Security Department and national security issue, and the national security is at stake, and we can't do this. And it's going to be a very weak hand to play between now and February 27th. And I don't know what's going to happen. I anticipate a clean funding bill to come back from the Senate, fully funding DHS, and my leadership saying, oh, we're going to fight this on another battleground at the next CR or the next debt ceiling, and I've heard that too many times.
So you're saying we should just be depressed?
I'm sorry?
You're saying we should just be depressed?
I'm saying what we need to do is really push the Senate to pick up the phone and call Tim Scott and Lindsey Graham, pick up the phone and call your friends in other states and have them call their senators and say, take up the House DHS bill as it's written with the Mulvaney language, Idaho language in there, and send it to the president. Then if there's any shutdown over this executive amnesty, it's on him. It's not on us. We've done what the American people want us to do. We've said we're going to fund national security. We're going to fund the DHS everywhere except for their ability to enforce executive amnesty. That's what has to happen. That's where America needs to get engaged, and they don't need to wait until tomorrow. They need to do it today.
Well, I agree, and because it is. It's going to run right up. It's going to be below the surface, right? Right up till the 25th or something, and then it's going to pop up.
Yeah. I mean, I've had conversations this week with a lot of the conservative leaders within the Republican Study Committee and others about we have got to push our leadership to quit operating in crisis mode, to quit pushing us up against a fiscal cliff or pushing us up against a debt default or pushing us up against a government shutdown, to act early enough. Now, the House has acted early enough on DHS funding. Now it's up to the Senate. And I sent a letter, me and over 40 of my colleagues signed on to it, sent it to Mitch McConnell over in the Senate, that when y'all finish Keystone Pipeline, how about take up next the DHS funding bill that the House has passed as it's written? I'm not trying to manage the Senate. What I'm trying to do is say, you've got support on the House side for taking that up. We need to send the president. And that's what I hope they will do rather rapidly.
Now, if so happens that it was successful, what would that mean to immigration, the amnesty program? If, let's say, if it got pushed through, if it happened and it was overrode, let's say that everything went the way that you're talking we'd like it to go, what would that mean?
Well, they won't have the money. Immigration and Customs Enforcement and USCIS, which is U.S. Customs and Immigration Services, it processes the visas and processes a lot of the documents for these illegals once they're granted amnesty. They would not have the money to do that. They wouldn't have the money to continue building and leasing their office space over in Arlington. They wouldn't have the money to hire the 1,000 employees that they're trying to hire to process these applications or these amnesty visas for the illegals. So they wouldn't have the money to do that. And if you don't have the personnel, you really can't do it. So we would have effectively stopped it from the purse strings, which is really a constitutional role of the House. If we disagree with the president, if we disagree with any government decisions or direction, we can stop the funding. And that's an immense power that we've been very ineffective in wielding over the last number of years. And I think we ought to wield it often in this Congress.
Sure. Well, that sounds encouraging if everybody gets off their butts, right?
Yeah, they call their Senate, call their senators. And I know Tim Scott is with us. I'm not quite sure about Lindsey because I hadn't had that conversation with him, but I'm not saying he is or isn't, so I don't want you to think I'm saying that he's not. I just don't know, okay? But I'd say if you believe, like I do, that the executive amnesty was wrong, the president has usurped the Constitution and then got into the legislative decision-making and process, if you think all that's wrong and we should stop it and pick up the phone and call Lindsey Graham and Tim Scott, tell them to take up the House DHS funding bill and pass it as it's written and send it to the president's desk, that's the best thing we can do right now.
All right. Well, we appreciate you getting that word out, and I know a lot of our listeners will pick up the phone when we finish here and start working on this.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem is we've become so passive, and the problem is a lot of people, even though the Republicans won, it was going to be a great day, already there's a lot of disillusionment.
And rightly so in a lot of ways because you hear Republicans, even on the House side, saying, well, we can't do that because we don't have 60 votes in the Senate. You know what? We couldn't do it in the last Congress because we didn't have the Senate because Harry Reid was over there. Well, now we do have the Senate. And let's let them worry about getting 60 votes. Let's worry in the House about passing stuff that reflects what we talked about on the campaign trail. I'm sick and tired of folks just talking the talk and not willing to walk the walk in Washington. They get up there and they get reelected and they start serving and they get on a cushy committee where they can raise money and then they feel like they're invulnerable. So they quit governing. I mean, think about this. How many congressmen have you ever heard, not just in South Carolina, but anywhere, a Republican and Democrat, that's not for a balanced budget? Most of them are for balancing the budget, living the way that families and businesses have to operate, and that's with a balanced budget. Well, if that many people believe in a balanced budget, why in the world don't we have a balanced budget in that? You know, people talk about a flatter, simpler, fairer tax code, and we shouldn't have this convoluted IRS and this convoluted tax code, but why do we have a convoluted tax code? How about taking up the mantle and actually focusing on a simpler, flatter, fairer tax situation that lower, in my opinion, for the American people to be able to keep more of their hard-earned dollars? And so if you run on that, how about operating and walking the walk in Washington? And that's really what we're trying to focus on, is pushing the Republican conference in the House to do what we say we're going to do on the campaign trail.
Sure. I agree with you 100% on that. It should be standing up and doing what's right. But let's move on and talk about some other things. The president has just said that he wants to make a huge part of Alaska off limits, make it a wildlife center or whatever. Why?
Well, I mean, he's an environmentalist, and he's also a climate change activist and believes in man-made global warming, and they don't like fossil fuels. They don't understand fossil fuels drives our economy. With transportation fuels and heating and cooling fuels and electricity, but that's been their desire to take a lot of the areas off limits. They tried to do it in the Gulf of Mexico with a moratorium. We've been lucky to try to push Sally Jewell and the Department of Interior to open up more in the Atlantic, but at the same time, they put out a draft proposal that is going to open up a small area in the South Atlantic, which I'm pleased that actually got included. But at the same time, they closed two oil-producing areas off the coast of Alaska, and then the president talks about, you know, making the Arctic National Wildlife Area a wilderness area, which is untouchable, and when really we're only talking about a very, very, very small area on the northern slope that would be active in any kind of drilling or producing operations, and it just shows their environmental slant. But I'll say this, not on my watch. It won't happen. That bill's got to come through Congress in order to make it a wilderness area. Actually got to come through the Natural Resources Committee in the House, and it will not happen, I promise you. We're going to leave that on the table.
Okay. All right. Now, a couple of other things here real quick, and then we're going to have to let you go. But you were selected as vice chair of the Congressional Sportsman's Caucus. Now, what's that about? That sounds like a cushy one there, Jeff.
Well, so you've got a group called the Congressional Sportsman's Foundation and the Congressional Sportsman's Caucus that was formed probably about 20 years ago. And it's just a caucus like a lot of other caucuses within the Congress that focuses on certain issues. I'm on the Western Caucus that focuses on Western state issues because I'm interested in Western state issues, how they manage water and other things. Well, so the Sportsman's Caucus is one of those. We really push forward public access to public lands, hunting and fishing rights for Americans, even like things like lead bans, which would affect your fishing weights or your shotgun shells. You know, access to the Gulf of Mexico for red snapper and a whole issue with limits on what people can catch in red snapper. Just a wide myriad of outdoor hunting, fishing, shooting sports and outdoor access, and enjoyment, issues. And so I'm a vice chair in this Congress, and that means in the next Congress, assuming I get reelected, I'll be the chairman of that. And then it's interesting that I was involved with the Congressional Sportsman's Foundation for a very, very long time. I was chairman of the Sportsman's Caucus in Columbia in the State House for one session of the General Assembly. Mike Pitts was the chairman before me. We're passionate about this. We're involved in the National Assembly of Sportsman's Caucuses at the state level, and I actually traveled as an auctioneer up to Washington about 4 years in a row to do a huge fundraising auction for the Congressional Sportsman's Foundation for 4 years before I got elected to Congress. So it's something I'm passionate about, and that's working for the hunters and fishermen and people who enjoy the outdoors and shooting sports in the halls of Congress.
Sure. I think it's great. I was just having a little fun with that one, and I think that is right up your alley. One more question. American Sniper, you got pretty upset on Facebook about people that were slamming American Sniper.
Yeah, I mean, I read the book about 2 years ago and kind of became a huge fan of Chris Kyle. I mean, he is a true American hero, has more sniper kills than any soldier in American history, counting all the wars, Vietnam and World War II as well. He protected American lives, and the movie depicts that very well. It depicts the struggles that he had with making that decision to take a shot on people that were going to harm his brethren, his men and women that were in arms with him. And it also, I thought the movie did a great job depicting anguish that he felt being separated from his wife and his children. They had two small children, babies, while he was in Iraq on his tours. And so he's a patriotic American. He's now a dead hero, unfortunately. I won't tolerate anyone tarnishing the reputation or bad-mouthing like Michael Moore did, a true American patriot like Chris Kyle. And so I lashed out on Twitter and Facebook, and it was the right thing to do, and I'll do it again.
Did you lose any followers?
I'm sorry?
Did you lose any followers on Facebook?
I think I gained followers. I don't think I lost any followers. I told folks, I said, look, if you agree with Michael Moore and Liam Neeson, just defriend me. I think I picked up friends.
That was exactly what I was talking about, Jeff. Hey, Gracie's excited about that, too. Thanks so much for calling us. God bless you, and keep up the good fight. Thanks so much for calling us this morning.
And thank you. God bless you, and we will talk real soon.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye. Yeah.